It has been an interesting journey, hasn't it? As we go about life these days, we find ourselves often wondering about the next step. Can't tell you how many conversations that I have with people that are concerned as they look at the signs and they see the circumstances of the world and wonder out loud, are we drawing close to the end? Let me answer that for you. We are. We have been doing that all along, and certainly we find that as time goes by, both personally but also in general, the pace seems to quicken. The world is rushing headlong into its own demise, and that has been the way of it. Since Adam and Eve sinned, it's been that way. We seek out that which is destructive, and we live in a world that is utterly corrupt. We're not trying to fix it. We're not trying to reform it. But rather, God has given Christ that it might be redeemed. And so we are redeemed, but not out of our circumstances, rather in the midst of them. As we have heard these testimonies that Brad alluded to, and as we share just in general conversations with one another, we are continually brought back to the need for the redeeming work of God in the midst of our circumstances. Interestingly enough, the Apostle Paul does likewise. As he writes his letter to the Philippians, he does so in a manner that I guess you could consider it a sort of salutation, but he has prayed for them, he has prayed with them, and has praised God for them, but now he shares some of his own circumstances. And he reminds us that what we encounter today is something that believers have encountered all along the history of the world. Paul begins a discussion of his situation in Rome, but he usually doesn't do that in his letters. He'll normally do it at the end and talk about whatever circumstance he may be confronted by. But the circumstances of this letter are different. Paul knew the church was anxious about his imprisonment. They had sent one of their own, Epaphroditus, to him to bring a gift and then to stay with Paul to offer assistance as he may have need. They knew that the case that was before the emperor was a test case. No Christian had been accused and been brought before the emperor's court before, so that whatever decision would be rendered was going to influence all Christians throughout the empire. The church also knew there were divisions among the believers in Rome. Not all of them were working together, and not all of them were working with the Apostle Paul. Paul writes about that in order to soothe the fears the Philippians may have had, but he's also teaching a higher standard of biblical unity within the church, not only for the church in Philippi, but also all churches throughout the ages. But the most likely reason for the early address of his condition and the circumstances that he's dealing with in writing to the Philippians was simply because they were friends and they cared about one another at a deep interpersonal level. He wanted to calm their anxiety, but at the same time, he wanted to encourage their continued commitment in the partnership of the gospel in which both shared so directly. In fact, it was the gospel to which he would repeatedly turn as the one indisputable value above all else. It didn't matter to Paul what issues were at hand. His constant refrain was only that Christ is proclaimed. I look at this and I'm reminded that it's so easy for us to get caught up in our own issues, not to demean them at all, not to in any way sidestep the weight of whatever pain you may have experienced. But pain is universal, and death is a constant looming specter that reminds us of the brevity of life, but also its fragility. When we see all of this in light of the whole, it reminds us that if the only anchor that we have or foundation upon which we stand is circumstantial, we will forever be insecure. However, if on the other hand, our faith is anchored and rooted in that which can never be moved, no matter what the circumstances bring, then we have a sure and certain foundation upon which to build and for which to look forward. I want to share with you then a message entitled from the text itself, Only That Christ Is Proclaimed. It's in Philippians chapter 1, verse 12 is where we begin, and it takes us through the first part of verse 18. And what we find in verses 12 through 14 from the apostle is a divine perspective. He has a divine perspective. He says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. Most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Paul doesn't talk about the bad things he's encountered. He doesn't talk about the hardships. And if you think about it, there is a lengthy discourse that could have taken place. It would have been common for the Philippians to actually expect the worst from him. But rather than detailing his struggles, Paul takes a divine perspective on his situation and declares that everything that he has experienced has ultimately contributed to the gospel. Now, while Paul's not going to detail his problems, I will. Excuse me. In a general fashion, if we look back, keep in mind that Paul has now been in prison between 3 and 4 years. His last journey took him back to Jerusalem, where he was almost immediately arrested. Having been arrested, he was held, and his life was at great peril and risk. Those who opposed him had attempted on numerous occasions to kill him and were unsuccessful. And the Roman proconsul had him moved to Caesarea, where he was again imprisoned for over a year. Eventually, he finally had a hearing and a trial. Those who opposed came from Jerusalem to present their case against him and accused him of dissension. They said that he was proclaiming a new sort of religion and that in doing so, he was undermining Rome itself. He was not only accused of sedition, but he was also accused of strange religion. Now, there's a lot of strange religion, and it's ironic that given all of the strange religions that were so proliferating in that era under pagan rule, that it would be Christianity that would be singled out as strange. And yet, the Bible tells us over and over that the world looks at what we believe as foolishness. So it should come as no shock or surprise that this would be the case that Paul would represent for all of us. After he finally appealed to Caesar because he didn't want to go back to Jerusalem, because he knew that if he did, he would be killed, he was then transported by ship. He was still a prisoner and was transported along with other prisoners under guard. It was a long and arduous journey that ended in shipwreck. And while it would have been assumed that everybody on board would have died, none of them did. He was bitten by a snake in the process, a poisonous snake. And it was also assumed that he would die from this, but he didn't. He continued to trust, he continued to believe, he continued to follow God, and in the process, God led him through that until eventually he arrived in Rome. once again imprisoned and held. And he continued to be. So that this letter is actually being written from the place where he is confined to the Philippians while he's awaiting trial, still not knowing when that will take place. What will the ruling be? It could be death. He could receive a capital judgment that would result in his beheading. He could be released. He could be restricted in some way or with conditions. Nobody knew. He had appealed to Caesar, and the decision would be entirely up to him. We do know that eventually he will be released, and he will again resume his mission work for a short time before he will be again arrested and then killed. Paul is writing to encourage people. These are the circumstances through which he has already endured in order to come to the place where he writes about a single subject more than any other in this letter to the Philippians. Joy. How does one have joy in a journey that is so difficult? How does one find an anchor to uphold them in the midst of such turbulence? How can there be hope when everything that surrounds and seems to constantly invade is hopelessness? That is the message of grace. That is the hope of faith. This is the hard work that is done to believe and to cling to Christ alone. Paul is an example of that, but he's also a teacher. He helps us not only to understand what it looks like, but he helps us to understand how to follow as well. So that when we see this divine perspective as he completely ignores all of the situations, circumstances, and other issues that are being brought to bear against him, what we are reminded of is that what he is doing is choosing to focus on what he does know, what he can trust, and the one in whom he has placed his faith. Paul declares that everything that has resulted has worked together. He says, I want you to know that what has happened to me has served to advance the gospel. All that he has endured leading to the moment of writing has not prevented him from continuing his mission to share Jesus. How easy we find excuses to avoid commitment to Christ. How easy we find reasons why we cannot share Christ. How easy it is for us to be thwarted in any effort or distracted from any focused attention on the gospel. And yet here what we see is that when all of those other reasons would have overwhelmed a normal person, the Apostle Paul says, by the grace of God, what has happened to me has served to propel the gospel forward so that more people are hearing about Jesus than ever before. It is a good reminder to us that all that God can do in the midst of our circumstances, that he can redeem any circumstance for his glory and for the gospel. This is exactly what Paul meant when he wrote to the Romans and said that God is able to work all things together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. It is unfortunate that we get so caught up in the circumstances of a world that is dying that we lose the divine perspective that would give us a clear focus on what truly matters most. But in verse 13, he says, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to the rest that my imprisonment isn't for sedition, it isn't for treason, it is for Christ. He says that the gospel has spread through the imperial guard. The imperial guard represented a security force of 9,000 men, highly trained, and they were held in Rome as a protection for the empire and in particular for the emperor. He does not say that they've all become believers, but rather that they have all heard about Jesus. So 9,000 people that are a part of this imperial guard are having conversations among themselves about this man, Paul, and the gospel he proclaims. He says, as he includes all others, that they are also aware of his plight, stating plainly that now they know that he's not there because he is a threat to the empire. He's not there because of any sort of political maneuver. He is there because of Christ. Paul lived for Christ and for the manifestation of his work in the world so that he would rejoice because it had become clear that all are now hearing about Jesus. Isn't it interesting how so often we are eager to share about ourselves or about our circumstances or about our feelings or about our complaints or about our aggravations or all of these different things, and it can run the full spectrum from the positive to the negative, but it's ultimately still about us. But notice how he chooses to set aside those kinds of issues in order to make sure that what people are hearing from him is about Jesus. It changes everything when we realize that the gospel is more than just something that we casually consider in moments that seem to arise along the way, but rather it becomes intentional as a part of every conversation that he seems to have with others, so that ultimately, whether they're asking him why he's in prison or they are encouraging him to plead out and not put himself at greater risk, he continues to focus attention back to that of the gospel. He says in verse 14, most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by his imprisonment, are even more bold to speak the word without fear. Another result of his imprisonment is the other believers in Rome have been emboldened to proclaim Christ. Think about it. If someone who represented you and someone that you were close to or someone who held the same conviction and calling that you did had been put in jail and was awaiting a ruling that could either result in their death and maybe even a proclamation that would make what you believe to be illegal, and that will eventually happen in the Roman Empire, but not at this time. If that were something that was, would you kind of pull back and wait to see how this goes? Pull back and wait to see if this goes in a positive way and he's cleared of any wrongdoing and then rush back in, or would you rush in not knowing what the outcome is going to be? What we find is that people are rushing in. They're moving in a direction to align themselves with Christ and to capitalize on the publicity that has been brought to the name of Jesus as a result of the imprisonment of Paul. It is an interesting thing and a predicament that is not unlike many others that have occurred down through the ages of history. Christians have been encouraged and raised up through every age to proclaim Jesus, more often not because of the good times or ease, but because of the conflict and cost. Christianity always flourishes in times of persecution more than in times of plenty. We grow fat and weak and indifferent. We become self-centered and more concerned with our own issues. As a result, we lose sight of the gospel. But when all of the things that would otherwise comfort are taken away, then what is it that we have to hang on to? It's then that we discover that what matters most is that relationship in him, because regardless of what happens to us in this life, we have one to look forward to that is what we were actually created for. Hardship can clarify, perhaps better than anything else, what matters most. So Paul's divine perspective is a great encouragement that results in the gospel being proclaimed. But there is a disputed motivation for those who share this ministry. Paul brings that to light in verses 15 through 17. He said, some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. So not everyone was inspired to preach Christ from a sincere motivation. Some, Paul said, did so out of envy and rivalry. It seems odd to find such sentiments in the midst of Christian ministry. And yet it has always been like this. It is like this among believers as we jockey for position, as we seek to assert our own will or dominance or agendas within whatever groups we become associated with. We find ourselves as pastors many times being very territorial. This is not an uncommon thing. One of the things that longevity and age does for you is you get to the point where you just don't care about that anymore. Now, I'm not going to say that I didn't at some point or that I don't even have any spark of it left in me, but I will say that for the most part, I don't care. One of the things that has helped me along the way to understand those kinds of issues more clearly is the reality that God has called us to be kingdom people. And so kingdom people recognize that they are a part of a larger corporate group of believers than can be limited to one congregation. So Temple Baptist Church is not the end of all things for me. It is rather a small portion that we represent in a particular locale that is a part of a much larger kingdom group of followers of Christ. So that whatever happens to the glory and benefit of the kingdom of God, regardless of what it costs the local body, is to the glory and kingdom of God. Sometimes we have to choose to be more kingdom associated and more kingdom focused than we are even local. If you want an example of that, Philippians is the perfect example. The Macedonian believers did not care nearly so much for themselves in their own interest and their own welfare as they did for others, so that they were willing to give out of poverty. They were willing to serve at great risk and in the midst of opposition because they were too enamored and enthralled with the gospel to be concerned with what otherwise seemed pettiness. It is not an easy thing, but it is one that we must all hear the message that the motivation for ministry must spring from a pure heart that is devoted to the principles of truth. But Paul says that was not the case for everyone. He refers to those who opposed him out of envy and rivalry as brothers. And it is interesting that he never questions their message. In fact, it seems that they are proclaiming the gospel just as he did. He only questions their motivation. Others, he said, however, proclaim Christ from goodwill. These direct their support toward Paul, in contrast to the former group who do it out of animosity. It's hard to get a really clear historical image of what's going on there, because there's just not enough information. Paul doesn't talk about it. And we don't have external information to supplement it. But here's what it seems has happened. The Christian group within Rome has grown pretty prolifically. Paul wrote to them even before he had ever met them, and he had nothing to do with the establishment of the church there. We do know that a lot of the believers who were in Rome that were a part of the work that had flourished in the capital had been people who came from other places, Asia Minor, even Judea, and some of the places in Greece and or Macedonia that Paul had established churches. They had gone from there to Rome for whatever reason, and then they helped to establish churches. So there were connections. Paul wrote to them in the book of Romans to help disciple them and to provide them with a sound theological base on which they could build and expand the church. He wanted to go there, and now he has come. But when he gets there, what does he find? He finds people that are jealous of him. is popularity. And they don't want to give that up, or they want that for themselves. Rather than doing what God has called them to do and leaving that result to Him, they're trying to undermine what Paul is doing so that the attention of those who serve him will shift to these new leaders. This kind of stuff is just, it's draining. It's exhausting to imagine it in the church at that era as it is today. And yet that is exactly what was going on. There's another possibility as to why they would have preached in a way that would have undermined or been a threat to him. And that is because in the Roman world, for someone to be imprisoned the way he was meant that they were weak or that they were of lower status socially. And so no one wanted to be associated with that. This new Christianity that is flourishing, they want it to grow and they want it to be a part of the work of the gospel, but they also want it to be cool, to look cool, to be attractive to people, to draw them in. Sound familiar? You might be reminded that when John spoke to us about issues like this, he reminded us that we are in the world indeed, but we're not to be of it. And when we use the same sort of techniques and strategies that are more closely associated with modern business practice, or we use the same techniques and strategies that have more in common with politics than they do with faith, or when we use the same strategies and techniques that are played out in social media and other groups that often do more harm than good, then we are slipping and sliding down a path that is making us not just in the world, but now also of it. This is the challenge. I think some of that had to do with those who opposed Paul. Paul just wanted a pure gospel to be proclaimed and people to come to salvation and repentance, that they would be redeemed and then discipled and grow up in Christ so that they become multipliers of the gospel as well as they shared Christ with those that they encountered along the way. He wasn't concerned about status or leadership roles or things of that sort. He wasn't concerned about money or material gain. He wasn't concerned about social acceptance or political power. He was concerned only about the gospel of Jesus Christ, and those who were opposing him were doing so because he just wasn't very cool. And they didn't want to be appearing that way. I think that is a struggle that might even resonate more clearly in our minds if we would consider it honestly than a lot of the other issues. So Paul says some of them are doing this for the wrong reasons. He said some of them, though, are doing it from goodwill. The goodwill group also preach out of the motivation of love. Love for Christ, love for Paul himself, love for those who are lost. This love is further enhanced because they understand that Paul is indeed representing them as well as all believers as he states, "I am put here for the defense of the gospel. So I will remain fixed for the cause and sake of the gospel." In verse 17, though, he returns to the former group who proclaimed Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. The wrongly motivated group, he expands on their twisted understanding. They are driven by selfish ambition, insincerity, and a desire to inflict further pain or poor reputation on Paul while he is in prison. It's hard to see such a description and not question the faith of a person so motivated. I really struggle with that, to be honest with you. I get angry reading that because I can imagine myself in prison having sacrificed all in order to see the gospel move forward, and then to have these schlubs come along and question me this way and undermine me. That would take a huge load of grace to temper in someone like me. Now, I don't know if the Apostle Paul had the kind of fiery attitude that I possess, although I think he did, based on some of the things that he said to the Corinthians. But I'm telling you, that would be tough. But once again, it's not about me, is it? And it's not about him. It truly and always must be about Christ. So that we see they are driven not by the appropriate motivation. Christian love compels us to be concerned with not just what we say, but the way we say it. Not just how we focus our lives, but also how we conduct them as we move toward that fulfillment. Finally, we see a desired outcome. In the midst of this disputed motivation, there remains a desired outcome. Verse 18, and this is just the first part of it. It says, "What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed." This is where I took the title. And in that, he says, "I rejoice." Paul sets an example for the Philippians to emulate. His prestige, his reputation, and personal feelings are secondary to the preaching and advance of the gospel. He says it very plainly. Only that in every way, whether in pretense, those who oppose me, or in truth, those who do so out of goodwill, that Christ is proclaimed. Paul is not immune to any personal hurt, but he does not put his personal feelings above the progress of the gospel. What is important is not his vindication before the Roman court or his rival fellow believers, but it is the defense and confirmation of the gospel that will go forward for the salvation of others. I think about this because church these days is complicated. Being a pastor is a lot harder than I used to think it was going to be. I remember a purer time, a time of calling, a time when all I wanted to do was to do that which Christ had put in me. I didn't think about all of the other things that would go along with that. Even in the preparation and in those early years, that's what I did. From the time I was in college to the time that Kathy and I got married and then seminary, all in those early years, mainly all I did was preach. And it was a lot of fun, and we traveled around, and we did that for churches that didn't have pastors in college. Then in seminary, I took on a church that was out in the country and was really struggling and needed someone to come and pastor and lead them. And I did that, and we didn't have administration at Mount Carmel Baptist Church. You know, when we talked about budgets, the numbers were really small. I remember when they raised my salary from $80 a week to $100 a week, we went out and bought stuff. It was $20 for crying out loud, but it was $100 a month. That was equal to what we were spending on groceries. And that was after we had to start buying formula. I just remember all of those things being very simple. And then all I could think about was how desperately I wanted to serve full time in a church and how I wanted to be a part of that. And what did God do? He answered that prayer and he brought me to Sullivan, Missouri. And then I found out that there's a whole lot more to leading a church of this kind than there was of that. Even though I'd grown up in a pastor's home, my dad pastored churches that were very much like this one in size and scope, and we'd seen that over the years, I was completely unaware of all that went on. Spending time worrying about physical facilities and the maintenance and the care of those things and the insurance and the legal implications and the policies and the regulations. Thank God that we have Craig, because I can tell you if we didn't, I could not do this. All of the kinds of things that so often consume the time and energy of what we are to be about. And it's no different than running your household. And how difficult that is to manage all of the schedules and the activities and the cost and the consequences and the jobs and the careers and the relationships. All of that consumes us to the point where what's left that goes towards something that truly is going to last is very little. What this message of the apostle tells us, and we can't all be like Paul. In fact, no one is like Paul. But what it can tell us is that in order for us to see Christ glorified in our lives personally, in our church corporately, and in the kingdom universally, in order for that to happen, there has to be a time where we take a hard look at who we are and realize that Christ is not someone that we simply add on when it's convenient to our lives. But for us to be true disciples, called for an eternal purpose, he must be our lives all the time. So that whether we're here or wherever we are to live for his glory. So that we can, along with the great apostle, agree that regardless of the circumstance and regardless of what others think about it, our concern be only that Christ is proclaimed.